Welcome to SidePod Chat. It's a very strange sensation. We are joined on the line for the first time, I believe. I don't think we've ever had a voicemail from or spoken to on a podcast to... Actually, this is a good question. Who are we speaking to? Because this is a name that I'm going to struggle to pronounce. Is it Nylise?
Nisha.
There you go. See, I'm looking card. I'm looking at your business card and I'm thinking, I don't know what that word says.
You're not the first. No, it's an old Irish name. I've been asked that question many a time.
It's not great when you go to introduce somebody and you realise in a fit of panic, you're not actually sure you've called them by their first name before. we've always referred to you, and I imagine a lot of listeners to Side Podcast will know you as Manip F1. Am I pronouncing that right? Is it Manip or Manipe?
I say Manip, but everybody else says Manip, so I've stopped correcting people and I just take it on the chin and move on, you know?
Where did the name Manip come from?
Oh, that's a secret. No, we can't be telling people that.
Really? Okay. Is it not French?
No, it's not. I don't think so. It comes up a lot on French sites. It probably has some meaning in French, but no, not from where I got it.
Okay. Will you ever declare that, or will you take that to your grave?
We'll see, maybe. Some people do know, so it's just a matter of asking the right people.
Interesting. Okay, that sounds like a challenge. Right. So so it's Nisha from Manipe F1.
Yes.
This is good. I feel already like I've learned something in this show.
Fantastic.
As a bit of a background then, we know you primarily, I think we found you on Twitter, twitter.com/ManipeF1, and that led us to your website. Specifically, I think you came to our attention because you were one of the first internet sites to be invited into the F1 paddock. Is that correct?
I think that's correct, all right.
That's quite a privilege.
Back in the day, about 10 years ago, I think Atlas F1 were an accredited website, but in the past few years, I think I was the first as part of a new drive by the FIA to get websites in. So that was last year in Valencia, which was one of the least entertaining races. But
a great introduction.
Yeah, that was my first race as a proper F1 journalist. So it's good fun in that respect.
So you are the real deal. You go to the F1 paddock, you know the news, you're on the ground, and you've been to more than one race this year.
Yes, I've been to six this year. Unfortunately, I only went to the European ones from... I went to Valencia again this year, and everyone then up to Monza back in September. So I'm suffering from withdrawal symptoms at the moment, not going to any races, but such is life.
You started Manipe in 2004, is that correct? Did I read that correctly on your website?
Yeah, I don't have any specific date. I don't know when I started it. I can't remember, and I never wrote it down, so sometime in 2004, yeah.
Do you work on the site by yourself?
Yes, all by myself, unfortunately.
It seems like a huge amount of work, because you've got the primary site, you've got a forum, you've got a blog, you've got the news sections, you run your own fantasy F1 game. You have one of the largest collection of F1 stats I've ever seen on any site anywhere. At one point, I was looking at an alphabetical list of lubricant suppliers throughout the ages. At which point, I'm thinking, how on earth can one man create all of this all by themselves?
Well, when I started it back in 2004, it was just kind of an experiment, really, of creating a website and seeing how it went. But it kind of grew from that, and I think it was last year... On the 1st of January 2009, I launched the whole results database with, as you say, all the lubricant suppliers and all the results from the $800 races that had been. And the news has been there since late 2004, I think. And I started the blog last year, and was it this year? This year I started the blog, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just to give me more scope for writing opinion pieces, because obviously with the news, it doesn't offer you much scope to be writing about your own opinions and thoughts.
Yep.
So that's what I started the blog for, really.
And also, you've got the Fantasy F1 game, which presumably you manage all by yourself too.
Oh, yes, that's the other one, yeah. I started that last year, I think 2009, yeah. Just a bit of fun for the site, because there's not much other kind of fun things going on at the site. It's all news and results and everything like that. So I said I'd start that for a bit of fun, and it's going well. There's I hand out a few prizes at the end of the year, so it's a bit late to be starting now, but get back next year and have a look.
We'll definitely keep an eye on that. There are quite a few. I think this year we had something like 30 something requests to join different leagues. That there are quite a few around there, but we will certainly take a look at it. Do you mind me asking, do you do this full time? Is this all you do, or do you have other sources of income as well as F1?
No, I'm actually a student at the moment. I kind of do it part-time-ish. I have some other work that brings in money. Obviously, you know yourself that it's impossible to make money with websites.
No kidding.
So I'm hoping to branch out in other areas in journalism to see what's out there. But at the moment, no, it's kind of a part-time thing. Hopefully in the future, then we might make it a full-time thing and make a living out of it, but that might be further down the line.
How in the blazes can you afford to get to the paddock for 6 races this year when you're just essentially a student? I say just a student as if it's, you know, a second-rate thing, but you're a student, which I'm assuming limits your income and takes up a lot of your time. How in the blazes do you afford to go to 6 races and do all of that?
Let's just say my savings account has taken a considerable hit in the last couple of months.
It's an act of dedication.
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean, I'd do it again. It was absolutely fantastic. You know, money can't buy, really. You know, it was sensational.
Something else that comes to mind. Obviously, you're based in Cork, Southern Ireland. That seems unusual in terms of positioning for an F1 journalist. Obviously, you grew up where you grew up, and you don't get a say in that. But do you find that there's not too many people from your area who are doing what you're doing? How is Formula One covered in Cork, and how did you get into it in terms of friends and family being into F1?
Well, my family isn't into F1 at all, no interest in motorsport whatsoever. I got into it with a friend who we kind of, back in the day, in the late 1990s, the early 2000s, Formula One was shown on our national television station, which is RTE. So we got into it that way, and then RTE, the F1 coverage, switched over to the Setanta pay station. So we had to get BBC into the house. But no, I mean, I was introduced with a friend, and I started the website, and I wasn't hugely interested in it when I started the website, but it kind of dragged me into it further, and, you know, the two complemented each other nicely, so it was kind of strange, you might say. But no, F1 isn't big in Ireland at the moment. Obviously, back in the day, we did have Jordan Grand Prix winning the odd race here and there, and we had Eddie Irvine and people like that, but there's nothing like that anymore, and the sport isn't shown on terrestrial television, so it's difficult for people to watch it unless they go out of their way to buy a subscription to Setanta or have BBC on their television. It's after losing a lot of popularity, but you know, there's still a big market for it there. I see sometimes on Twitter with the Irish trending topics that after F1 races that the F1 topics would be listed there, and the newspapers and things still cover it. So that there is a market, but it's after reducing massively in 10 years.
So you essentially watch exactly the same coverage that we watch, which is Eddie and David and Jack.
Yes, absolutely.
And so does that cost you extra money? I mean, is it not cheaper to get a Setanta package? It sounds more expensive to get the BBC into your house.
Well, we can get a Freeview satellite in Ireland where you pay €200 or €300 to get the satellite dish in the box into your house, and you pay nothing else then forever, right? As opposed to paying for Sky every month or whatever. But no, I mean, Setanta then would cost, I think, is it €10 a week or something like that? But it's just easier to get the BBC in and have the BBC coverage on, however biased they get.
Yeah, there is a case of that. Do you know how the Setanta coverage stacks up compared to other international broadcasters?
Well, I did watch it once or twice a few years ago, and their pre-race show, it can't really compete with BBC, because BBC are there on the ground and they've got an absolutely colossal team behind them. They've got big money. They've you know, huge people, production team and everything, all working just for this one program, which is what, you know, 1 hour pre-race and pre-qualifying every weekend. They can't compete with them on that. But during the race, they have David Kennedy, who is used to race for Shadow, I think, back in the 70s or 80s. And they've got Declan Quigley with the main commentator. And a few years ago then, they also had Gary Anderson, who was one of the world's greatest designers. And they were absolutely... Yeah, they were miles ahead of the BBC with Ledyard and Brundle. But the... I don't know how good it is at the moment, but they used to be very top-notch on it.
Understood. What else have we got to inform the world about you? Not only do you write for your own website, but you're also writing for the e-magazine GP Week. Did that come about because Correct. You were in the paddock?
Yes, it did, absolutely. In the paddock last year in Valencia, I introduced myself to the great Will Buxton and his chum Adam Hay-Nichols. They're kind of a little bit older than me, but around my age bracket. And you might know, but the rest of the F1 media is kind of slightly more middle-aged or that other end of the scale. So I kind of palled around with them because they're the same age group as me. So then Adam Hay-Nichols took over the editorship of it when Will went to Speed TV in America, replacing Peter Windsor. And Adam took me on board just to help him out, and it's been a great experience because writing for my own website, I don't get guidance, so to speak. I'm doing my own thing, and whatever I like, I write about, and whatever I don't like, I don't bother writing about. So it's been very educational, and so it's good so far.
And for GP Week, you are a columnist, but you're also listed as the editorial assistant, so I guess that must be a slightly different role for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I just do news and some features and various bits and pieces over a race weekend or a normal week, so it keeps me busy, but it's very good fun.
Talking of income, you don't appear to have any advertising on your website either, so I'm guessing you're not in this for the money specifically.
No, I used to have advertising. I used to have Google Ads, but I took it off, I think, at the start of this year. Because number one, the amount of money that they pay out is wouldn't feed your cat, you know.
Yep.
And second of all, it's very cheap. It reduces the if you were to bring in other advertisers at a later stage, it would reduce your ability to be able to bring in bigger money because it looks so cheap and it devalues your website, so to speak. So I just said, I'll take it off. I won't be losing much by not having them there, and it looks better anyway, I think.
Interesting. I mean, we essentially went through the same process on SciPodcast because we used to have Google Ads and we dropped it and can't say we've missed it. Unusually, there aren't that many sites who have taken that step.
Well, at the end of the day, you know, if it brings in money, it brings in money. That's how some people view it, but I don't think it's worth it, really. I mean, it's difficult enough to make money with proper advertisements, but with Google Ads, it's just impossible altogether.
In terms of where you think you're going, you said you started this because you were interested in journalism. How do you balance the difficulties of managing a website with writing? Presumably writing is your key interest, and then secondarily you then have to work on the website in order to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the vast majority of the work that I do on the website is writing the news stories, reports, and then the odd piece for the blog. I mean, you're talking maybe 95% is the writing, and then the rest goes into the website, like doing the results and changing things for next year. I'm doing a bit of development work at the moment, which is a few changes for next year. But no, I mean, the vast majority of it is just writing because of the way I've set it up, that it takes very little work during the year to keep it running, to keep the website running. So it's very easy to be adding content like the results and the news and everything like that. I didn't, when I started, there wasn't any WordPress that I was, that I knew of. So I just wrote everything from scratch. So it's been tailored just to my needs. So it's easy to keep it running. But no, I mean, obviously the my main focus would be on writing. That's where I want to go. But there's a limit to how much you can write. So
How did being in the paddock affect what you were able to write and how you were able to write? Presumably, say 2 years ago, the kind of things you were writing were based on press releases and second-hand information. I noticed that today specifically, we had a question in the side podcast comments. We were discussing the 2011 calendar and the fact that Shanghai was earmarked for further homologation, and we were in the midst of a discussion about the where's and the why fors and the maybes and endlessly speculating without any information. And in the meantime, you'd called up the FIA and got confirmation and found out exactly what the reason for that was. Presumably that's made a huge difference to how you write, being able to call up the FIA and, you know, Formula One teams and the people who, you know, really know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there'd be no point spending all that money to fly around Europe when you're watching the race on TV screens like you do at home without any commentary, I might add. If you can't go down to the paddock and speak to the people that are involved, speak to the drivers, speak to the team principals and the engineers and everything like that, that's the advantage that you do have when you're in the paddock. And then when you're not in the paddock, you can be ringing these people up and finding out what's going on, as opposed to, as you say, your commenters there who don't have that kind of access to the teams. I mean, within my first day in the paddock in Valencia last year, I learned that people on the internet, with no disrespect to them, but they know very, very little about the sport and what's going on. I mean, you've got kind of three or four levels of knowledge in Formula One. You've got the fans at home who know what's given to them on the internet and on the TV screens. You've got the journalists like myself and other people who know a little bit about the sport, and then you've got the people within the teams who know everything that's going on. And I mean, even the journalists themselves, who are very tuned into the sport, only get the real news fed down to them, and it could be weeks or months before it's fed down to them from people within the sport, because there's just so much going on. It's so difficult to describe how little people actually know what's going on in the sport. And as I say, I don't mean any disrespect, but it's just impossible for them to understand what's going on. It's not the fans' fault that they don't know what's going on. It's just the information isn't being fed out to them. And as you say, with the story today that was about the Chinese Grand Prix, that the circuit has to apply for a new license, is this kind of thing that you can do? You can get onto the FIA, you can ring them up and say, what's going on here? Why is there a star beside China's name? It's just a huge advantage to have, really, and it brings you into a deeper level of understanding of the sport. And as you're asking, has it changed the way I write? It's been a huge change because, I mean, I've travelled to 8 races now, 6 this year and 2 last year, and what you learn is absolutely immense. I mean, you come away from a Grand Prix weekend and your head is just absolutely buzzing with information. It feels like you're kind of, it's this very strange sensation, but every time you walk into the paddock and you walk up and down and you're talking to people, you're learning more and more. And I mean, this is the same for every single journalist, not just me coming in amateurish, so to speak, not having done a lot of races. I mean, the amount of information that's out there is absolutely enormous, and everybody's talking and giving out their tidbits, so it's a very strange experience.
We did ask Joe Saywood, when we first started speaking to him, to tell us who he thought put on the best spread and offered the best food in the paddock. But no amount of questioning could we get an answer out, a definitive answer out of the man. Would you be prepared to go on record and state which team has fed you the best and looked after you the best?
Ooh.
Without offending all of the other ones.
Yeah, well, I haven't eaten at all the teams, to be honest. Some of the teams are they only allow invited guests in. Others are very open. McLaren and Red Bull, rather, are the most open. They allow anybody and everybody into their motorhomes. Last year, if you go back to last year, I remember I had dinner at Toyota once or twice, and that was very nice. And strangely enough, Renault have since taken over their motorhome, and the dinner there is still very nice. So there might be a correlation between the niceness of the dinner and what motorhome you're in, but I wouldn't be able to give you a definitive answer, no.
The best oven in the business, there you go. You heard it here first.
Must be, yeah.
I was going somewhere with that, somewhere important, and now I've forgotten. The oven threw me. Oh, yeah. Talking of the calendar, then, we now have it's set in stone. We know what's happening for 2011. There's another race added to the calendar. It's a 20... Oh, it feels terrible to say this, really. 20 races. That's a long old season. Are you feeling positive about that? Because at the moment, that just seems like one too many to me.
It's very long, all right. I mean, when I was doing the races in Europe this summer, you don't get any time to recover. It's just constant going and going. And, you know, you leave home on Wednesday morning, Wednesday afternoon to get to the country you're going to, and then you're not back until Monday or Tuesday, as it was for me sometimes. And as I was saying, you know, you come away from a weekend, your head is just buzzing with information, and you're mentally tired and you're physically tired coming away from a weekend. It's so intense, you know. And I was only doing 6 races, so you can imagine what it's going to be like for people who've done 19 races this year and 20 races next year. It may seem easy for you at home, sitting in front of the TV watching the race every fortnight, but it's tough. It's not easy, you know. It might be a glamorous job or perceived to be glamorous, but it's not easy. It's pretty tough. Adding another race to the calendar will just make it more difficult, but, you know, people will survive. Obviously, the costs are going to go up for journalists and teams and everything, and we're probably not going to get any more money for an extra race, but that's life, you know. It's just what happens.
And do you have any concrete plans in your mind as to what races you think you might be attending, given the opportunity and obviously if you can sort out the finances?
No plans at all yet, but hopefully we'll get to a few. Fingers crossed.
The testing calendar has also recently been coming together. You've now got, we're looking at something like 4 tests in the new year. Are you planning to go to any of those? Have you been to a test before? Is that something you're interested in, or is it not as key as attending a race?
No, absolutely not. I mean, when you've got a race, the whole press corps is there, and the press corps is kind of as essential for getting information as having the teams and the engineers and the drivers there. I wouldn't bother going to a test knowing that the money I could spend going to a test, I could spend going to a race, which would be much more beneficial, both to myself and to my readers and readers of GP Week, because it's more, I mean, who really cares about testing, you know? Racing is what matters. Any reader of a website would rather have information about a race weekend than a meaningless test. So I don't see any point really of going to a test. Maybe, I mean, I could see the point of going to 1 or 2 tests before the season starts to see what's going on, but I wouldn't be interested in going to every test.
Do you know much about the young driver test that's scheduled for the end of this year? Slowly but surely, a few more names are creeping out, and you've got Sam Bird, I think, was announced earlier this week. He's going to be he's going to be testing for Mercedes. Do you know much more about who's going to be there? Anyone particularly that you're looking out for?
Not much. No, I haven't. I haven't bothered finding out who's on where. I know that BMW Sauber are going to be testing Gutierrez and Perez for the 2 days. Williams will be testing Maldonado, obviously. I think Ferrari tests the top 3 drivers in the Italian F3 Championship, and I wouldn't be surprised if they test Jules Bianchi as well. He's one of their driver academy drivers. Apart from that, I'm not too sure. McLaren might be testing Alexander Sims. Didn't he win the McLaren Autosport BRDC award last year?
Right. Yep.
I think I'm not too sure now. I'm just thinking out loud here. You might expect Red Bull to test Ricciardo, who's their test driver, I think. But apart from that, I'm not too sure.
There hasn't been a huge amount of news in the F1 world this week. It's been very quiet as teams and various journalists make their way to Brazil. One thing that did pop up on my radar today was something that Nicholas Todd said. He was complaining, I think, in Auto Sprint magazine, which was then translated onto Autosport. Let me quote what he said. He said, I'm very worried because up to a few seasons ago, drivers would step up to Formula 1 on merit. Drivers who got there, thanks to financial guarantees, were sporadic, and it mostly regarded the small teams. Now, I'm guessing he's complaining that these days, pay drivers are more prevalent, and that's an issue to him. Do you think that's the case? Do you think that Formula 1's gone too far that way, and now money speaks more volumes than talent?
Well, that was always going to happen in a recession, you know, in a global, worldwide recession. I mean, if you look down the grid at the moment, you've got Sakon Yamamoto, who's paying per race to be in the seat. You've got Vitaly Petrov, who was taken in as a, you could say, as a pay driver. He was taken in to bring sponsors in from Russia. You could argue that Fernando Alonso is a pay driver, having brought sponsorship from Santander with him. You could argue that Lucas Degrassi at Virgin is a pay driver. You know, I mean, it's a very fine line. I mean, I think, is it Nicholas Todd was speaking there in reference, probably in reference to Pastor Maldonado, who is being tipped as taking Hülkenberg's seat at Williams next year. Now, Maldonado has something like $15 million plus in sponsorship from the Venezuelan oil company, whose name I can't remember, PSDVA or something along those lines. No, Nicholas Todd does manage Maldonado, and you're wondering, why is he beating up about pay drivers?
I am now, yep. I hadn't made that connection.
Well, I mean, Maldonado's won the GP2 championship in the past couple of years. The GP2 champion of all has gone into F1, the exception being Giorgio Pantano. And, you know, Maldonado is getting a lot of bad press about being a supposed pay driver, getting a driving phone one next year. So you have to ask the question, really, if the global economic crisis didn't happen and money was still flushing around F1 and teams didn't have to take on pay drivers, you know, would Maldonado be considered as a driver of the talent he has, or would he still, would the pay driver tag still be hanging over him? It's a difficult one. You know, I mean, everywhere in categories of motorsport, money is an issue and always has been an issue. I was at the GP3 prize giving ceremony after the Italian Grand Prix in Monza, and the amount of talent that you can see there that just will never get into F1 because they don't have the money, it's crippling, really. You see, of course, next year Sergio Perez is going to BMW Sauber. He's probably going to finish second in this year's GP2 championship, but he's bringing with him a big chunk of cash from Carlos Slim with Telmex. He's the world's richest man, or was, or is close to it, and he's got the talent. He pushed Maldonado pretty hard. He didn't have the luck. I mean, do you say, is he more worthy to get into F1 or less worthy than Vitaly Petrov or Karun Chandok or somebody like that? It's a very difficult line to draw. And does Maldonado deserve to get into F1? I mean, you know, he has the speed. He's won the GP2 championship. He's statistically the most successful GP2 driver ever. So,
didn't know that.
You know, I think he's won something like 10 races, which is more than anybody, and he won 5 feature races back-to-back, which is a record as well. I think nobody had done 2 or more before that. So he's shown he has the talent, but the thing is, he's been there for 4 years, so you could say that he's gone beyond it, so to speak. But then you look at Petrov, who was also in GP2 for 4 years, something along those lines. And nobody kicked up a fuss about him when he came in, because he'd finished second in last year's championship, I think. You know, it swings and roundabouts, really.
Interesting. I learned so much from that. I was listening intently there, because, I mean, I personally don't follow GP2 in that much detail, and I hadn't realised that he had that strong a background. Which is strange that there is a lot of internet talk about him, criticism, rather than, it's not even talk, it's just out in that criticism of him being a pay driver. Do you think that's just short-sightedness, lack of understanding, or where does that come from?
Well, I think it doesn't help him that he's touted to replace probably one of the best rookies of the year in Nico Hülkenberg.
Aha, yep.
You know, fans probably feel a bit sore about that, because Hülkenberg has done more than deserve a spot in F1. He's been pretty good. He stepped up the pace versus Barrichello in the second half of the year, and he's, as Patrick Head was saying, he really does deserve an F1 seat. But the problem with Williams is that they've got big budget problems, and unfortunately, without a quick car, they can't get the money in like they would if they just brought Maldonado in and he brought them X millions from Venezuela. You know, Hülkenberg does deserve a seat in F1, but the conditions aren't there for him to stay at Williams.
That is a shame. I guess we will see. Do you think Hulk has a chance of being placed elsewhere? I know that Williams are trying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'd be silly for any team to not to take him if he's on the market. He's a very good talent. I mean, you could see Renault coming in and taking him instead of Petrov, because he's proven to be a lot less crash happy, and he's just quicker. Barrichello pushed Button pretty hard for the title last year, and Hülkenberg has been level pegging with him in the last few races. So, I mean, it'd be very silly for any team to pass up on taking Hülkenberg. I mean, I've read a few places that with the Williams/HRT deal that was announced, I think was it yesterday or the day before, that Hülkenberg might go to Hispania. I mean, that'd be a pretty big step down from scoring points at Williams to probably the team that's going to be at the back of the grid again next year. So you really got to look elsewhere and see. You've got Renault with a spare seat. You've got the new teams, Virgin and Lotus, both have spare seats, and you could see them being competitive and scoring points next year. That's about it. But I can really see, it'd be difficult for me to see Hülkenberg out of F1 next year. It'd be a calamity, really.
Looking forward, but not quite as far forward as next year, you've got a potential title showdown this weekend. And if that isn't the title showdown, then it will be the next weekend, because then we're out of races. What do you see happening in the next fortnight?
In the next fortnight. Right. I'm very bad at predictions, but I'll give it a shot anyway.
Here's the thing. We'll get you. We'll get a prediction from you, and then we'll come back to you after the end of the season and see how close and accurate you really were. What's going to happen in Brazil? It's going to rain, right?
I don't know anything about the weather, but you got to look at the drivers who are challenging for the title. You've got Alonso, who I don't think he's ever won there, but he's won both his titles there, so it's a happy hunting ground for him. Hamilton lost his title in 2007 there, but won it in 2008, so he's got good memories and bad there. Button won the title there last year. Weber won there last year. And Vettel came second last year, or third or something like that. So they all have good memories of Interlagos, which is never a bad thing. I mean, you've got to really consider Button as being out of the title fight at the moment. People say that because Kimi did it back in 2007, wasn't it, that Button still has a chance. But there are very different circumstances. Button has four drivers ahead of him, all of them that are quicker consistently, quicker cars in the shape of Ferrari and Red Bull, and Hamilton has been considerably and consistently quicker than him all year, so he's pretty much out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Alonso has an 11-point lead, I think, and it's very difficult to see him messing up. You know, he's made a few mistakes this year in Australia and Monaco and China, and most recently in Spa, but it's at the end of a championship fight, and he's done it all before. He's won two of them. He's a cool character. He's very, very quick. He's got a quick car at the moment. Red Bull are still fighting with each other and can't seem to finish races. You know, I find it very difficult to see past Alonso. Of course, if Red Bull get their act together and put all their weight behind Weber, you could see him winning the next two races, which would automatically give him the title. But will Red Bull trip over themselves again in the last two races? It's possible. If they do, it's Alonso's title for sure.
So your head is saying Alonso for the title, but who would you like to most succeed and take it?
I think I speak for everybody in Formula One, be it fans, journalists, engineers, or anything. Obviously, apart from Alonso's engineers, but everybody would like to see Weber win the title. He's a great guy. He's a great character. He's so down to earth. He's had it tough for the last God knows how many years of his career. I don't know how many years he's been in F1, but you know, he's been with Minardi. He's been with Williams, Jaguar, all these crummy teams that haven't done much for him, and he's now finally in a car that can win titles, and he's done pretty well this year. There's been times when Sebastian has been quicker than him, but over the course of the season he's been pretty good, and he's however many points ahead of him now. I think it's 11 points, he made a pretty bad mistake in Korea. That was one of the, apart from the mistake in Valencia running into the back of Kovalainen, you could argue that his mistake in Korea was his first bad one, really. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, he was one of the only drivers to actually make mistakes in the wet, which I found somewhat strange. He's such a nice guy that everybody would like to see him win the title, and it'd be pretty bad for him if he didn't, given that he's had such a difficult career and he's so close within touching distance, but whoever wins it, and that's about it.
And where will you be watching the race on Sunday? It's an afternoon race for you, as it is for us, right?
Correct, yes. I'll be watching it at home in front of the TV. And then, given that it's an afternoon / evening race, I think it starts at 4 o'clock. Unfortunately, I'll have to be working hard from then until about 9 o'clock at night to get the copy out to GP Weekend on Manipe F1, because obviously GP Week is published early on Monday morning, so that gives us a tighter time frame to get everything out to Australia to be put into the magazine and published on the morning.
It goes to Australia?
Yes, it's run by Australasian Motorsport News, I think. They publish it for us, so we have to get everything out to them pretty sharpish on Sunday night.
Good Lord, I had no idea. So you're effectively doing, you're like a mini Joe in that respect, because obviously at the end of the race, he himself and David Tremaine worked very hard to get the GP Plus out for Monday morning, and you're working to exactly the same deadline.
Pretty much, yeah. We'll be working to that kind of a deadline, all right, on Sunday, but usually we have plenty of time to get the stuff shipped out to Australia, but just because Brazil has the time zone is a bit different, we get more pressure on us this time around.
And so the domains people need then, manipef1.com, that's the place to go after the race for to see all of your writings. Do you do a race summary post-race?
Yes, I do. I do that straight up after the race, and then I write up the... I don't do much post-race news on manipef1 because I'm just so busy with the GP Week stuff. But you'd see all the race news in GP Week covering the main points of the race and the controversies and the great drives and things like that, and any crashes that there might be. And then I leave any other writing to later on the week for the website for Manipe F1.
And GP Week is GP Week, GPWEEK.com. And that's Monday morning.
Monday morning, I think it's something like 9 o'clock. In the morning, it's published usually. Sometimes it goes out a bit earlier, but you can subscribe. You can add your name and email address to a list, and we'll send you an email once it's published.
Good stuff. I presume it's quite fun doing that. You said earlier it's a different challenge, but I imagine it's quite fulfilling to see it come out.
Yes, absolutely. It's totally different to running a website, because with a website, you're constantly looking for news and writing and reading and everything, but with a magazine it's once a week, so it's a lot less intense, but it's very good once it goes out on the Monday morning and you can read what you write in a little online magazine. It's very fulfilling. All right,
so you are a star. Thank you very much for your time. We promised, I think it was way back in April we first discussed having a chat with you. We met you, didn't we, in where did we meet you? Was it in London? No, Joe's audience with Silverstone.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. I remember that. That was good fun.
That was
recommended, I must say.
Yes, that was great fun. A perfect setting. Lovely place for a meetup and a drink and to chat Formula One. Back then we said we'll definitely talk to you in August. Now it's November. So I do apologise that it's taken us quite so long to have a chat with you. We will definitely, though, we'll catch up with you post-season, because I'm going to hold you to that Alonso prediction. Even if you really wouldn't mind Webber winning it. And we'll send as many people to your website as we can, because we love you. There was one snippet in my mind I wanted to bring up, actually, and I can't quite remember what it was, but I recall watching a race, it might have been earlier this year or last year, possibly, when you dug a rule out and posted it on your Twitter account during some, I think there may have been a controversy mid-race or at the end of the race, and pretty much everybody on the internet was calling the wrong rule, and the BBC had it wrong. And you were the only voice of sanity in a huge sea of nonsense. And we haven't forgotten it. I don't know if you can remember what it was, though.
Wasn't it in Bahrain this year, Chandok, he didn't drive in any of the practice sessions, and people were saying that he wasn't going to be able to race.
That's the one. And you knew that, yeah. He could.
Yes.
And the BBC disagreed, and you were right on the money. It took almost 30 minutes passed between you suggesting that they were wrong and the BBC finally correcting themselves. And then when Chandok got in the car, they thought, hold on a second, that's not right. But you caught it from the start, and it's just a small snippet of just how good you are, because, you know, just calling up the FA this week, I think you did it last week, and then there was a discrepancy between the lap offset in Korea, and you picked it up from the FAA documents, and you got in touch, and you came back with the confirmed corrections, which is fantastic. We very much appreciate the news that you bring for free. It's fantastic, and we encourage everybody to go to Manip F1, or Manip F1, as I have been calling it now for nearly 2 years. So I'm going to do my best to correct my pronunciations, and hopefully we can speak to you again soon.
Absolutely, yes.
You, sir, are a legend. Thank you.
Thank you too. Bye-bye.